Welcome to the relationships panel, which is always one of my favorites. You guys know that, right? Relationships. I'm going to introduce each author, and each author will come down, take a bit of time to read and tell us a little bit about their books. If you are the sort that likes to ask questions, the microphone will come to you when it's Q&A time, and you can get ready with your questions, so be thinking about it. Otherwise, I will ask more questions. I will go in order this way. Starting with Sarah Healy, is the author of Can I Get an Amen and House of Wonder. She lives in Vermont with her husband and three sons, and her brand new book is The Sisters Chase. Well, it's over the summer. Brand new-ish, and is fabulous. Next up, Joshua Max Feldman is a writer of fiction and plays, born and raised in Amherst, Mass. He had lived in England. He has lived in England, Russia, and Switzerland. He currently resides in Brooklyn, and The Book of Jonah was his first novel. Sylvia Brownrigg is the author of several acclaimed works of fiction, four novels, Morality Tale, The Delivery Room, winner of the Northern California Book Award, Pages for You, winner of a Lambda Award, and The Metaphysical Touch, and a collection of stories, 10 Women Who Shook the World. Her books have been included in New York Times, Los Angeles Times list of notable fiction, and have been translated into several languages. She lives with her family in Berkeley. We're happy to have all three of you here today at the Boston Book Festival. Welcome. Guess we'll go in order, Sarah.
Okay.
So you can either take the microphone or take the stage, whichever.
I'll take the stage.
Okay, I'll get out of your way.
Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to be here, and thank you all for coming. And I'm actually going to read a passage that I haven't read before. So I'm going to take it away. It wasn't long after her mother's death that Mary learned there was no money, that Diane Chase's estate, if it could even be called that, was in the red. The motel owes a significant amount in back taxes, an attorney in a brown suit told her, his elbows resting on the laminate wood desk. What does that mean? Mary asked sharply, but Mary knew what it meant. It meant that the only inheritance Diane Chase had for Mary and Hannah was the water's edge, and it would be like a stone tied to their necks, pulling them slowly through the depths. It means that the debts owed by the water's edge are likely to exceed the value of the business, including property itself.
The volume's too loud.
Oh, it's too loud? Okay. He took... How's this? Still too loud? Okay. He took his glasses off and looked at Mary. It's quite an unusual situation, he said, to have so much responsibility at your age. You're only 18. And Mary hated him. She hated that his plump fingers had run over their mother's private documents and papers. She hated the way he looked at her now, with leering curiosity. Because it wasn't just the water's edge that belonged to her. It was Hannah. In the eyes of the law and everyone else, Mary was Hannah's guardian. This has been incredibly useful, said Mary, standing abruptly. Just incredibly fucking useful. That night, while Hannah lay sleeping, Mary stood in front of the utility sink and stared at the steady stream of water coming from a faucet, slowly grinding her jaw from side to side. The laundry room at the water's edge was tiny and down to one working fluorescent bulb, but Mary had taken to going there since Diane died, sitting on the concrete floor and leaning against the washing machine as it worked, feeling somehow steadied by its rhythmic motions. When the water was near scalding and its steam thickened the air, Mary pulled an old plastic bucket from one of the makeshift wooden shelves and stuck it into the sink, letting it fill. She grabbed a scrub brush, a container of Common, and marched out into the cold night, the hot water sloshing onto the ground as she walked. Then she pushed open the door to a vacant guest room, went into the bathroom, and dropped to her knees. She plunged the scrub brush into the water and let her hand linger there, thinking of nothing quite as satisfying as that moment that the shocking temperature, then the heat against her skin. She went to a new room each night and scrubbed it clean. She cleaned till her heart would pound and strands of her hair would stick to her neck and her forehead. She cleaned until the skin of her fingers would pucker then crack. And when she ran out of room, she started over again. So it was on the floors and the tubs and the sinks that some of Mary's ferocity and fear was unleashed. It was after another such evening that she returned to her and Hannah's room to find Hannah awake, lying limp on her bed with a terrible cough. Bunny, said Mary, rushing to her sister. And that night, Mary sat in the bathroom with Hannah on her lap, steam filling the air and calming Hannah's breath. When she fell asleep, Mary held her still, watching her chest rise and fall, tensing as her body quaked with its periodic coughs. Mary was late to homeroom the next morning. Hannah hadn't wanted to go to Mrs. Poole's. No, she whined, her arms wrapped around Mary's neck as Mrs. Poole tried to pull her away. I want to stay with you. You can't, Bunny, whispered Mary into her hair. She kissed the top of her head. I have to get to school. And when Mary walked into Mrs. Violette's classroom and the squat, dowdy teacher asked for a note, Mary went right past her and sat at her desk, acknowledging neither the teacher nor her request. I asked for a note, Miss Chase, repeated Mrs. Violette. Mrs. Violette hated Mary, hated her beauty and her insolence, hated her mind. Mrs. Violette, unlike many of the teachers of Bergen Shores, was entirely unmoved by Mary's recent loss. Mary rested her feet against the chair in front of her. I don't have a note, she spat. Then get back up, began Mrs. Violette, relishing each word, over-enunciating them. Go to the main office and get one. Mary stared at her for a moment, then made a noise of disgust. Stupid bitch, she muttered, shaking her head. Without another word, Mrs. Violette marched out of the room, and Mary took down her ponytail, shaking her long brown hair loose over her shoulders and looking out of the window as the class began to buzz and pulse with her defiance. Did you hear that shit? Mrs. Violette returned with Mr. Aletto, who said, all stern and somber, Miss Chase, please come with me. With her arms crossed, Mary walked behind Mr. Alvetta through the school's silent hallways into the main office. He nodded once at Bonnie, who sat at the front desk, and Bonnie smiled. All the women who worked at the school thought Mr. Alvetta was handsome. Mary followed him into his office, and he turned and closed the door behind her, and it clicked shut. When he looked back at Mary, he saw her face with her hands. I know I shouldn't have said it, she said, her voice muffled and wet with emotion. I've just had such a short fuse lately. Mary, please sit down, he said. But instead of sitting, Mary rushed him, burying her head into his chest and letting out a quiet sob that could break your heart. I know what you're going through has been very difficult, started Mr. Alvetto, gently laying a paternal hand on her back, as if thinking this were a moment he would be proud of soon, one where he would definitely handle the behavioral difficulties of a grief-stricken girl. And all of us here at Bergen Shores are here for you. Mary took a deep breath, the sort a mournful girl might take to steady herself. But as her chest filled, it pressed against Mr. Alvetto's. I know, she said, but the language you use towards Mrs. Violette cannot be tolerated. Mary lifted her chin and looked at Mr. Alvetto with big, wet eyes, then made the slightest adjustment of her hips. I'm sorry, she said, letting her gaze drop as she took another breast-expanding breath. She felt his hand drop down a fraction of an inch lower on her back. I feel terrible. She shifted her weight just a bit more, pushing her hips ever so slightly forward. So subtle were her motions that no one except Mary herself would be able to recognize their artful deliberateness. Mr. Alvetto backed up suddenly, red-faced and flustered. You shouldn't blame yourself, Mary, he sputtered, while trying to hide the bottom half of his body behind his desk. I think you need to take a little more time to cope with what's happened. Why don't you take the rest of the day and we'll start fresh tomorrow? And Mary almost laughed. Sometimes she just couldn't believe how easy it was. But instead, she made her face look tortured and let her gaze drop down to her feet, thinking only of her pleasure at the thought of Mrs. Violette learning that she had been given the afternoon off. Okay, Mr. Alvetto. I'll handle everything with Mrs. Violette. Mary nodded, still trying to look ashamed and remorseful. Thank you. So Mary went home, picked Hannah up from Mrs. Poole's, and took her to McDonald's for lunch. When's my birthday? Asked Hannah as she took a bite of her cheeseburger. On February 14th, answered Mary. Valentine's Day. I'm going to be 5. Mary made herself smile. You are. They got back to the water's edge just as the mail truck was pulling away, leaving a fresh crop of sympathy cards. There was a thick one on the top from her mother's cousin, Gail. Their Christmas cards always included a photograph, and Mary recalled the way her mother had always studied it when it came. In the lab, she was posed with her husband and son on a cream-colored couch, a large abstract painting hanging in the background. Mary heard her mother make enough comments to know that Gail and her husband had money. He was an entrepreneur and had recently been elected to the state senate. They think they're God's gift. After Mary put Hannah to bed that night, she filled another bucket with water and carried it, sloshing and steaming, into another guest room. And that night, as she cleaned, she pictured Gail's husband with his tan skin and dirty blonde hair. She pictured Mr. Alvetto blushing and hiding behind his desk. She pictured the lawyer with his shabby suit and fat fingers. Her hands were red and raw, her skin thin from water and the cleaners, but Mary scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed. She knew that she wouldn't raise Hannah in Sandybank. Sandybank is where people died. Her grandmother had died during childbirth, bleeding to death on the delivery table. Her father had lingered for only 3 months. Her grandfather had lingered for only 3 months after his diagnosis, and her mother had driven her car into a telephone pole. Her organs pulverized. Even the town itself died every winter. No, she and Hannah wouldn't stay in Sandybank. They would leave. They would disappear. Two princesses escaping into the night, running through the black woods with wolves at their heels. It was the two of them now, the last of their house. They would be deceitful when they had to. They would use the powers they were granted, and they would make their way back to the one person Mary always knew she would once again find. And that evening, the knees of Mary's jeans grew stiff and wet. Her hands went back and forth. She did her plan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Next up is Josh. Are you going to stay? Okay, this is the path. Okay.
Hello. Thank you all for being here today. I'll read a little bit from my more recent book, Start Without Me. This is a book about Thanksgiving, and I wrote it because I've always had really boring Thanksgivings. My family gets along really well. Nobody ever fights. So I decided to write a novel where Thanksgiving goes wrong and everybody fights. So I'm going to read from sort of the middle of the book. The main character in the book is a man named Adam. He is a former musician. He's sober now for the first time in years. And on this Thanksgiving day, he's invited to his family's Thanksgiving for the first time in years, now that he's sort of gotten his life together. And the morning of the holiday, he wakes up in his old house, and he realizes that he's terrified of his family and being there. And he gets in his rental car, and he drives away. And in an airport hotel, he meets a woman named Marissa, who is a flight attendant on a day-long layover. And they strike up a conversation, and he finagles his way into her car. Marissa's on her way to visit her in-laws. She's late. She needs to get where she's going. And Adam has convinced her to now take him back to the house that he fled from in the first place. So they're on their way up on this little road trip. And, yeah, I think that's enough setup. Oh, and the town Adam's from is called Roxwood. Adam found it harder and harder to sit still once the name Roxwood started appearing on the signs. 18 miles away, then 13, 5, 2, like a jittery countdown. By the time Marissa pulled off 91, his legs were bouncing at the knees, the fingers of both hands playing tremolos in the air of the dashboard vents. Driving along a two-lane street, Route 8, they came up to a complex of big box stores that had sprouted like mushrooms since the last time he'd driven this way. "Hey," he told Marissa, "I have an idea." She eyed him sidelong, not slowing down. "I really need to get up to Vermont, Adam." "No, I know, but I was thinking it'd be better if I showed up with a coffee maker." "A coffee maker?" "Before I left, I broke the coffee maker. Did I mention that? So if I have a new one when I come back, it's Thanksgiving morning. Nothing will be open." He sped up the tremolos of his fingers. "Maybe not, but I don't know, maybe," he said with a hopeful shrug. They came to the intersection with the right turn to the stores. For once that day, Adam thought, he caught a piece of luck, as the light changed from yellow to red just as they approached. 2 minutes, Adam promised. Her hands on the wheel didn't move. "What if we drive around the parking lot, and if everything's closed, we get back on the road? The house is only like 5 minutes from here." The thought of walking back into the house without the coffee maker was suddenly like imagining walking in naked. She slapped turn signal with a sigh. "Only because I need to find a place to pee." This was going to work great, he told himself. He'd get the new coffee maker gift wrapped. Maybe he could buy the paper and tape and do it himself. But he saw immediately that Marissa had been right. The stores had the graveyard silence of places of commerce closed for business. Barred gates pulled in front of the glass, long rows of nested shopping carts chained in place. All that was missing were tumbleweeds, he observed bleakly. He was about to give up and to tell Marissa to forget it when they drove by the Walmart, where a line of tents stretched to one side of the entrance. The tents were blue and red and army green, some shoulder-width narrow, others appearing large enough to accommodate 8 or 10. At the end of the row stood a longer line of people, mostly men, in heavy winter coats, gloves, beanies. "Looks like they're about to open," Adam said. "Or it looks like they'll be standing for hours," Marissa answered. "That's why half of them are in tents." "Let me jump out and ask." She rubbed an eye with her fingertips. "Why do you need a coffee maker again?" "As a peace offering. Can't you just apologize?" She made it sound so easy, as if it was just a matter of saying the words. "I'll be 2 seconds," he promised. Her phone pinged from the cup holder. She stopped the car with a jerk. 2 seconds, she said, picking up the phone. "I'm already late." She looked at the screen and frowned. "What is it?" he asked. "Nothing. My sister's texting me." "Why?" "Because she hopes that I'll..." Are you getting out or not? Getting out into the cold felt like dropping face first into freezing water. He slammed the car door behind him and half-jogged to the entrance. But even 50 feet away, he could see that the interior of the store was dark, deserted. He balled his hands into fists, blew on them as he looked over the doors, searching for some posting about when the store might open. Ah, fuck, he muttered. He took out a cigarette and lit it. Behind him, he heard a car honk. He raised his hands in acknowledgement, not needing to turn to check who it was. He walked over to the line of tents. Third in line was one of the larger ones. A heavy, bundled man sat in the portal in a lawn chair, a space heater between his legs, an iPad playing a football movie in his lap. He glanced up as Adam approached. "Can I get one of those, man?" he asked, pointing a gloved finger at Adam's cigarette. "Yeah, sure," Adam said, offering him the pack. The man pulled off the thick yellow work glove he wore, took out a cigarette, put it to his lips, and lit it with Adam's lighter. Adam heard Marissa honk twice, but he ignored it. "Appreciate it," the man said. "My brother was supposed to come by with a resupply this morning, but no sign of him yet. He was middle-aged, with patches of grayish stubble on the tops of his cheeks, and wore sunglasses on a neoprene band and a camouflage canvas hat with ear flaps. He reached into his canvas jacket, produced a silver flask, and offered it to Adam. "Would be grateful to repay the debt." Adam shook his head. "Nah, I'm allergic." "You get hives or something?" "No, I turn into a giant, self-destructive asshole." The man frowned, then shrugged. 10-4, he said, took a sip himself. "So are they opening soon or what?" Adam asked. The man shook his head as he returned the flask to his coat. "Another 3 hours or so." "Shit, how long have you been out here?"
18 days.
Adam whistled as he blew the smoke from his mouth. "I wouldn't sit out here for 18 days if they reanimated Elvis's corpse and he did a one-night-only show in there." The man chuckled. "If you only knew, brother. Tent's got a generator, Wi-Fi, a bunk with a minus 30 sleep sack, a grill, and a hot plate. It's as good as being home. Quieter, actually." He winked. "My brother comes by every other night to relieve me. Hot shower, see the kids. He did the 0800, 1800, Monday through Friday, last 2 weeks, so I could go into work. This is the fifth year out here. We've got the whole thing down to a science." He leaned forward and took out a black three-ring binder from under his chair, handed it to Adam. There was a piece of masking tape on the front, on which was written in Sharpie, "Walmart Doorbusters." Adam opened the binder. Inside were torn out pages from a Walmart circular in plastic sleeves, items on each page circled in red marker. Cell phones, laptops, video games, HD TVs, a snowblower. "That's the kill list," the man told Adam with satisfaction. "So you'll, like, run around trying to grab this shit?" asked Adam, flipping through the binder. The man chuckled again, ashed on the sidewalk. "Negative on that. After the employee got trampled on Long Island a few years ago, they have a whole system. In a couple hours, they'll give out numbers to let everyone in, and then let us go in groups. You get tickets for the bigger items. Like I said, it's a whole system." "Huh," Adam said. He stopped on a page with a red arrow pointing to a little kid's bicycle, pink with a cartoon princess's face on the seat. "Then you'll give this stuff as Christmas gifts?" "A couple things," the man replied, leaning over to put the cigarette out on the concrete. "Most of it I'll put up on eBay. I'll probably clear a few $100 in the end, but if you crunch the numbers, you don't even make minimum wage. It's not about the money. It's about the experience." Adam watched the trail of smoke rising from the tip of his cigarette, wafting skyward and disappearing in the clouds. As someone who had spent years of grueling hours in front of a keyboard for far less than a minimum wage, and often in environments far less hospitable than this man's tent, he concluded he was in no position to judge. In fact, he felt like he understood. The man's shared effort with his brother, the myopic and thus liberating focus on a particular goal, however obscure to the larger world. Fuck, this guy was practically a kindred spirit. "What's your name?" Adam asked. "Reginald. I'm Adam. Good to meet you, Reggie. Reginald." They shook hands. He heard Marissa honk again 3 times. Thank you.
That was great. Thanks, Josh. And Sylvia, rounding out the panel. You want to come here, too? Okay. It's the thing.
Thank you for those two great readings and for moderating and for coming out this afternoon. I'm going to read from my new novel, Pages for Her, which is a story very much about what relationships continue to mean to people long after they've ended. So Pages for Her is a sequel to a book that was published in 2001, which is called Pages for You, which was a very intense love story about a young woman, Flannery Jansen, who was from California, and she goes to the East Coast for college and has her first great love affair with a graduate student who seems named Ann Arden. And so Pages for You, you don't have to know that book to enjoy or appreciate this novel, but that story is, as I say, what it is to fall in love for the first time. And Pages for Her revisits these two women 20 years on. They haven't seen each other all that time. They each have gone on to have very separate lives. Flannery now lives in San Francisco and is married to an artist named Charles and has a young daughter. And Anne is a scholar and lives and teaches in New York. So I'm going to read from the beginning. Flannery has been invited to a conference called Women Write the World. So she's just dropped off her daughter at school and is going through that morning ritual of reading her email over a cup of coffee. She's had this invitation. Such politics were not central to Flannery these days. As an agitating 20-something, she had carried placards along the National Mall, protesting about women's rights and freedom of choice. But lately, the collective she poured her time into was made up of just three and was mixed in age and gender. From where she sat now in the cafe, Flannery saw her younger activist self through a backward telescope, tiny and out of scale. The idea of appearing professionally in a guise other than as the driver attached to her daughter or a softening embellishment to her husband appealed to Flannery, and she was flattered to be asked, but her first reaction on reading the dates and location focused on logistics. How could she get there? Who would look after Willa? And what kind of resistance should Flannery expect from her husband, Charles, to the prospect of her flying across the country for a gathering called Women Write the World? Do they? She could imagine her husband challenging with mock solemnity. It's a big world. That's a lot to write. Such were the dreary cogs that started turning in her mind before another item stopped all the machinery cold, then warm. At the last name she saw on the list, moderating the proceedings, there followed a name so vibrant to Flannery that it appeared to pulse in some foreign color on the screen, pomegranate red or a sleek jade green, not the black on gray of the others. Professor Ann Arden, a woman she once knew. And like Sarah, I'm going to read a section I haven't read before. I usually only read from the beginning of the novel, but in this novel, we see what's happened in Flannery's life and then what's happened in Anne's life, and then they meet at the conference. And so I'm going to read from the third section, which is set in New Haven. And this section is about Anne. And they've just been appearing at an event like this together. So this is Anne. She knew now that she wanted. The word went both ways. A want was a hollow that you hoped would be filled, and a desire, a pushing out toward the object of your affection. Anne wanted Flannery. She had lacked her all this time without realizing it, and now hoped to find her again, hoping the want was mutual. Together the following morning, they shared a stage and a fluid group discussion. Anne hosted or moderated, as though the job were a question of tamping down spirits if they ran too high, acting as a conversational thermostat. It was something she could do in her sleep, and nearly had to, given the rough, wide-eyed night she had spent tossed on squalls of uneasy revelation. Back and forth Anne turned, between the hollow and the push, the emptiness and the hope to quench it. The panel went well, with good-natured sparrings and playful riffs. There were a few good lines, one or two from Flannery. Afterwards, there was the necessary milling about. A woman with a pink streak in her dark hair cornered Anne to tell her enthusiastically, "You're such a rock star." She was a former student, now teaching. Anne tried to deflect her excessive praise. "Oh, hardly." She gestured at the women around her. "These are the stars. I'm just management, or the roadie." The woman laughed, then pressed on with a story about teaching Anne's book, The Awakening of Influence. "Thanks, Alice. It's good to see you. Excuse me, though. I have to find..." And she looked around, through the unimportant others, till she located her, Flannery. She stood still and graceful, her fair hair falling in a benign rain about her shoulders. She seemed distracted, staring at some unseen dust mite corner of the lecture hall, just thinking to herself, even here, even with all the noise about her. But when she caught sight of Anne, her eyes focused and widened. They locked with hers in relief. Hi. You're great, Flannery said, moving closer to ward off interruptions. And you had, as promised, an even hand. Thanks. You had some good lines. I liked what you said about Chicklet. The gum joke? Yeah, it's not new, but it makes people laugh. It did. You've got some serious fans, Flannery noted. The lady with the pink hair, for instance. Anne winced. She told me I was a rock star. You always hated all that, I remember. Flannery, the former fawner, was speaking levelly, eye to eye. Anne liked this. You didn't want groupies, even though you had them. My roommate Susan Kim would have taken a bullet for you. Plenty of people would have. They were standing so near each other that Anne felt Flannery's heat. Something deep in her loosened, though it was too soon to start swooning. Well, some fans, Anne spoke softly, were more persistent than others. Oh, I know. Delicately, so as hardly to be seen, Flannery's fingers slid along Anne's lower arm, a caress that lit places in Anne she had forgotten how to name. Some fans, Flannery's voice had both hint and humor in it, just won't quit. For a moment, Anne could only utter a low, guttural syllable of surprise. Yes, she managed with the small amount of breath she found. You've got to watch out for those ones. Margaret Carter was edging toward them from across the room, and Flannery millimetered away from Anne, back to a more proper distance. Listen, she said, in a voice almost empty of insinuation. I hope we'll get a chance to see each other more during the conference. It would be good to, you know. She let the sentence dangle, and as Anne collected herself, she wondered, like one professional admiring another, or an old hand enjoying the new slant of the former protege, when had Flannery learned such art? She'd had a couple of decades, of course, but still, here she was, keeping a person guessing on the edge of her seat, changing the pattern of Anne's breaths, touching her in the right spot. To talk together, Flannery finished. Then in the same smooth movement, turned to Margaret, who was smiling and congratulating them both on the morning. And Anne could only, catching herself, follow the younger woman's lead.
Thank you, Sylvia. And all of these books are available right back here. So afterwards, thanks for waving. The authors will be signing. And now we'll have a little discussion. Does anyone have a question before for any of the authors before we start? Okay. So relationships are at the heart of these books. And as I was listening to all of you, so many thoughts were going through my head, and one of them is, where do you sort of mine the material and get that sense of how a relationship works and how much of your own, certainly, would you put into that? And the conversation is and the dialogue is so real, and I just could imagine myself eavesdropping on any of these. So, you know, that was really the center of it, the relationships and, you know, what do you borrow and how do you write the rest? I think you have to share that, Mike.
Well, you know, speaking for myself, as I said before, my Thanksgivings are very boring and my relationships are very boring. I'm a very predictable person.
You don't look boring at all. Well, I don't believe this.
That's nice of you to say. But, I think for me, a lot of the fun of fiction is going places that you don't get to go in life. So for me, the kind of relationship I'd like to see portrayed in fiction is very different from the kind of relationship I'd like to actually have. For me, it's kind of like a sandbox, and I don't, you know, I wouldn't say like I've learned in relationships my characters know. It's sort of the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hey, so I realize I should have given you guys a little more background on my book before I started reading, but it's really the crux of the story is about the relationship between my older sister, Mary, and her younger sister, Hannah, who she calls Bunny, and they're 14 years apart. And really, I think, so Mary has, her mother dies, Mary ends up raising Hannah, and really, I think that a lot of it came from my relationship with my sons. I have three little boys. And before I had kids, I didn't realize that love could be a ferocious thing. I didn't realize that love was actually, like, was fierce. And so Mary is, in some ways, Mary will do anything. She'll do anything to care for Hannah and protect her. And that is really relatable for me. I mean, when you think, when I think about the lengths I would go to for my kids, that they're endless, it's limitless. So, and so that Mary having a very maternal relationship with her younger sibling definitely was informed by that kind of, that discovery when I became a mother.
Cool. Is this one? Yeah. So people have often thought about pages for you and now also about this book, that they're autobiographical. And I did not have a relationship like the one in Pages for You when I was that age. People often think it was just like a literal transcription of something that happened to me, which it wasn't. But the character of Flannery is quite close to me. So I feel I know her and had the same bad clothes when I was 20 that she did. And, you know, I'm as clumsy as she is and all that. But as you were saying, you know, I think other relationships in my life inform the relationships that are depicted in the story. And it's interesting that you made a link between having kids yourself and then the relations you depict in your novel, because that's one of the themes also in this story. Is one of the women, I mean, Flannery has become a mother and very deliberately has not become a mother, so that's a part of the element of the dynamic between.
Thank you. And what was, I mean, to write a sequel that many years later, was that something that your fans, and you talk, and I love the whole idea of the barbs and the good lines, and you all do a lot of panels, so is that something that gets discussed, like, you know, that was a good one, or I should have said that, or, you know, how does that filter into the work? And also the sequel question, because I'm sure the fans were, I know
they were clamoring.
It was clamoring going on.
It's the only time I've ever written a sequel, and it's really fun to rediscover and reacquaint yourself with characters after. I recommend it. I hadn't expected ever to write about those two women again. That story comes to a very complete, heartbreaking end, as it had to in the first book. It wasn't sort of that there was a little seed planted for the next book, but it was a very interesting process for me as a writer.
Yeah, I always wonder, like, what's a book that you'd love to see a sequel to, whether it's one of your own or that you've read, where you're like, you know, because sometimes I think it's annoying to authors to hear, like, we write a sequel and we want more because your story's complete.
Yeah. My publisher had us, not related to my book, had us fill out a questionnaire, you know, which book would you most want somebody to write a sequel or a prequel to? And so that was an interesting question as a reader, you know, like, which...
I guess I'm kind of ruthless, but when I'm done with my characters, I'm done with them. Like, I don't even remember their names. Like, until I'm just, they're dead to me. I've, like, they've served their purpose.
It's honest and ruthless.
Yeah, no, just totally. Yeah. People always say, well, what do you think they do after that day? Or what do you think they're doing later? I'm like, I do not think about it at all. I mean, anything. And I think that's actually, speaking of relationships, like, the author character relationship, I think, is really different than the reader character relationship.
Yeah.
It's almost like a coworker sort of relationship where you spend so much time with these people. Yeah. Whereas a reader, you have like this concentrated amount of time.
Sometimes in talking about or characters and that fact, there's a Iris Murdoch quote that characters in novels, you know, that were published a while ago are like friends who've moved to Australia. You know, it's like, you know, they're there somewhere, yeah, but you don't really.
Because readers get so invested in the characters, and that's certainly a tribute to your writing. And then you're on to, especially when you're on book tour, you're working on the next one or you're in edits or whatever, and do you have to really sort of remember where you are, like prep for your own event?
Well, it's funny because my mother gets... She, when she was like 3/4 of the way through reading this book, she told me that she's very religious. She went to church to pray for my characters. Oh. She went to church to pray that what she
Did
wanted
it work?
To have.
Did it work?
No, I was like,
Did
it
work
oh,
prayers
Mom.
Well, like you say, you do anything.
Yeah.
Anything for your child, right? I mean, that's right. It continues down the generations. So you're here for the weekend for the panels. Have you seen which panels were you wanting to get to? Hopefully none of them were happening right now, or authors that you had hoped to run into or that you got to see.
Author moment. I heard there was a Beatles panel, but I missed it. So I'm kind of, but I'm sure, it was really, really great. I don't know, honestly, for me, like, these festivals are so much fun. It's great to see people who love books. It's wonderful to be in a panel with other authors, with terrific authors, and yeah, it's just like, it is the best part to just be able to talk about your work and share with people who care about books.
Yeah,
and you know, you see friends. I live on the West Coast, so seeing friends and being able to listen to other people's readings. I had a chance to get a panel this morning on the short story, and that was wonderful.
Yeah. So. Who would a dream blurb be from for your next book?
Who what?
A dream blurb. Anybody. Anybody that you could ask anyone.
Who's blurbing? We'll say yes.
I know.
As it gets to yes.
I know. Because what is that? I don't know if readers always know how much is fraught with getting the blurb or working with your editors to figure out who's a good fit. So when people pick up the book, they think, you know, I want to read this.
Yeah, it's a funny process. You know, you want to get names on the back of your book, or people you admire, who people are well known to readers. But I don't know, it's a strange process. If you know, sometimes you know the person personally, and it's okay. But to sort of approach someone as a fan and ask for a huge favor, you know, will you read my book? Will you endorse it? It's a strange part of the process.
Because they're all here. You don't know who you can, you know.
I should go and start hitting people up.
I don't want to hold you up, Josh.
Well, it feels a little. I hate the whole blurbing process. It feels like panhandling. That's exactly what it feels like. You're basically begging people to read your book and endorse it. But
The flip side of that is I'm one of my weekend homework assignments is to write a blurb for a friend, and it's wonderful when you can pay back. And then you want to write the best three sentences. Right.
Is there a lot of pressure?
Everybody in this room read this book.
Right, to get it down.
Read
to
Anne
Rafe's
book when it's published in the spring.
Which one?
Anne Rafe.
Okay, book. Good.
Winter Kept Us Warm. You heard it here first.
Yeah, I think that readers. Does anybody have a question? Readers, audience. Oh, there's questions. Okay, the microphone is. Oh, we have the microphone.
Yes, we have extra.
Oh, well, I was told I needed to stay here and there would be running from. BBF.
Are you ever surprised by the reaction of your readers, and how do you get the feedback from them?
The question: are you surprised by reactions? I think, for me, all time, the way I know the characters is different than the way. It's really like introducing a friend to other friends. You never really know how other people are going to react. And it's funny you ask about how you get reactions. We were talking about the value of reading online critiques of your work and reviews and things like that. For me, the most enjoyable way is to just share it directly and just read it aloud and hear how people like it and that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that... I feel a lot of allegiance to my characters always, and I really love them, as problematic they sometimes are. And so I really want them to be understood, even if I just want to make sure that the reader really kind of understands where they're coming from and their humanity.
Yeah, what they said.
And I know there were other questions back here. Yeah.
Thank you for being here. This is a very unfair question for the three of you. You seem very young to me. Anna, I am always...
We are very young.
Yeah, right. I say that. Yeah, Then we are in agreement. I like to read books that I can hold it in my hands that are made of paper and ink. But today, you know, everybody say, you need to buy a Kindle, or whatever the other. And I say, no, I want my books, I carry my books, I have a strong back, I carry my books, yeah? But when you write and you go into publishing, I mean, how you think it in the near future or some years later, there is not going to be more... books as books, because also this event, you know, how can you sign in a Kindle the copy that I'm buying, you know? I mean, have you considered that as a writer? Yeah?
I mean, I have faith in the book. I think the book is going to endure. I think, you know, the reports of its death have been greatly exaggerated, although, you know, Kindles are opening up reading opportunities to people. I was a huge Kindle skeptic myself. I'm never going to, you know, sleep my life with a Kindle, but I have. And they are useful for travel, but it's true. It's not the object in the same way. I think Somebody, I heard somebody say a little while ago on this topic that, you know, there are different platforms for reading, and it's important that people are reading. People need stories. And I think I have to accept as a writer and a reader that there are different formats people will use. But
I like a physical book, too. I like turning the pages. I like feeling where my progression in it, in the book and the story. But I don't know. I think that when I'm at most desolate and cynical, I'm like, why am I writing books? Nobody reads books. But that's why coming to things like this is so heartening. I mean, it's really wonderful. So thank you, everyone, who continues to read books however you read them.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and just to echo that, like, I completely agree. I think the book as a physical object will be with us for a long time. And, you know, I think it somehow takes on, like, a moral quality, which one you choose. Like, if you're reading a Kindle, you're, like, this heartless futurist. If you're reading a book, you're some Luddite who, you know, wants to carve in stone. But it's really fine to read either way. They're both great ways to experience a book. And I think as an author, like, I'm just happy one would read it in any way. There's no, you know, there's no preference.
Mm-hmm. How are we doing for time? I don't see. We good?
Last question. Hi. Bruce Springsteen and Paul McCartney had like commentary and interviews and based themselves on a real story. Would you like to do that? Like make a biography of your own books?
A biography of myself or of someone else?
Yeah.
Of me?
Yeah.
I think I've established there's not much story to tell.
He has boring Thanksgivings that we know. We can hope for Hanukkah, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I started writing by writing nonfiction personal essays, and I actually do really love that format. And I think that it taught me that like all writing, no matter fiction or nonfiction, is about finding some deeper truth. But I love fiction. I'm a fiction. I love fiction. So I'm not. Yeah.
So you like fiction?
I like fiction.
Yeah. Sarah's fiction. Yes. Sylvia? No?
There's nobody writing my biography currently.
That you know of. It could be unauthorized.
The unauthorized biography
of Sylvia Brownrigg. Before we go, I also want to say I didn't introduce myself. Ellen Herrick did a lovely job at the last panel, but I'm Robin Call. You can find me on Facebook at Reading with Robin, Point Street Reading Series, and I host a weekly podcast on iTunes. And I want to thank Josh and Sarah and Sylvia and all of you for joining us at the Boston Book Festival.